And then I can do my intro and we'll roll on through.
Yeah, and if you've got answer, if you ask the same questions last time, it'll be easy. It'll be easy. Yeah.
I did all new questions just to.
You did not.
No, I made it easy for both of us.
I'm kidding.
All right, here we go. Hey, Stellar Woman fans, I'm your host, Mary Rectoris. Stellar Woman shines a light on female leaders making their mark in tech. Today, we have Susan Wortsman from MT3, a division of McCarthy Tétrault. Susan, thanks for joining me today. How are you?
I'm good. I'm very ensconced in my work from home office and keeping busy.
Definitely. How's it going working from home? What is it, week? I don't even know what
13, 14, I think. Mm-hmm. It's good. We were pretty much set up to work from home. So the technology part works, other than the, you know, interesting joy that we had trying to get us both connected on this call. But generally, it all works. It's, I think, the bigger challenge for people is getting used to being at home and the lack of socialization and being able to, you know, work closely with our colleagues.
Definitely. And I will, listeners, let you know that was probably user error on my part. Although we're in discovery, I am not the most tech savvy person. So I'm in marketing. So Susan, love to talk to you about MT3. So you started your business after being a litigator about 13 years ago. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. So I had been a commercial litigator for many years. I was a partner at a firm. I was the practice group lead for the commercial litigation group. And I think having established a practice and years of experience as a litigator gave me the background that I needed to support other lawyers and law firms on discovery matters. I'd done long trials involving like tens of thousands of records, securities litigation, class actions, and many productions. So while I was challenged by my work, I always wanted to start my own law firm. And e-discovery was just sort of a logical niche practice area that didn't exist in Canada at the time.
So you're based in Toronto, and when you started MT3, there were e-discovery firms in the US, but you were the first of its kind in Canada. Is that correct to say?
Yeah, so we were the first law firm in Canada devoted to e-discovery and data governance. At the time, and this was early days in the US too, there were a few firms, but mostly what there was in Canada were vendors that were offering e-discovery services, but those services were more on the technical side. So my firm, which was called Wortsman's at the time, was really a complement to the technical side and providing more services on the legal advisory side. It was designed not to compete with all the existing providers, but to provide a neutral sort of advisor to clients on the best practices and best tools. And I think that really helped us at the outset. Our neutrality appealed to our clients, because we weren't really selling anything. So we could assess and advise them. We were sort of the super users of the products that existed in the marketplace. And really not being the seller gave us added credibility in addition to all the e-discovery experience that we had. And that differentiator was what made the firm so successful in its early years.
That's great. And I think being the first of its kind presents opportunity, but there's some challenges, right? Because you don't necessarily have a clear playbook on how to get from A to B. So how did you go about establishing your business and learning what goes into it?
So I wouldn't say we had what we called a playbook at the time, but we had a business plan and we had a budget and we'd identified key clients that I wanted and we built a plan for workflow and a model for the firm. So, you know, like every other startup, we began with very, very low overhead and scaled as we needed, using teams of contractors and slowly building and growing our core team. I was also fortunate enough to have one large client from my litigation days who moved their e-discovery work to MT3 right out of the gate, which was a good starting ground. And then I think another big help for me in terms of the playbook was I was involved in Sedona and I had worked on a lot of multi-jurisdictional litigation. So I had good friends in the U.S. who had started e-discovery firms, and they were very supportive and provided a ton of advice to me. And then the other interesting component to my playbook was to meet with as many other connections that I had from the business community to get advice about marketing or advice about setting up a law firm or our finances, I reached out to business people, and I collected and capitalized on sort of all of the resources that I had, who had different expertise in different areas. Because then all of a sudden, I'm not just a lawyer, I'm marketing, and I'm HR department, and I'm the finance department. So I had to put that all together to start the firm.
That's great. So looking back now, or maybe if you're talking to someone that's contemplating going out on their own, what's the single piece of advice you would impart on them?
I'm not going to stick to it. I'm not going to have a single, but the first thing is to do something that you love and that you're passionate about. And the second, which may sound odd, is to think about what failure looks like. So if you're going to start your own business, think about the worst case scenario, which is what I did. And the worst case scenario for me was that I started my business and that it failed. And somehow I had to find a way to get my head around that and have a backup plan for what I would do after that or how I would respond to that. And when I did that, all the fear goes away and then the startup is less daunting. So once I kind of got to the place where I thought, well, the worst case scenario is that this doesn't work and I'll need to move on to the next thing, then I could launch with excitement. Someone actually gave me that advice, and it made a big difference to my ability to take the leap of faith and launch my own firm. So I really decided, you know, this is career number two for me. I was a litigator and I was a partner at a firm, and starting my own e-discovery firm is career number two. And if it fails, I'll go to career number three. So fortunately, I haven't had to go to career number three yet.
What is career number three?
Well, it's a lot different now, if what I would do now, if I was going to start over, than at the time. But at the time, for some reason, I was commuting and I was living in two different cities. And so I decided that if the firm didn't succeed, I was going to look for work in a not-for-profit organization where I could do more giving back to the community where I lived. I don't know where that came into my mind, because it would have been a complete switch of gears for me. But I think I saw this as a way to involve myself in the community where I was living with my family. I had also heard about some interesting opportunities in the nonprofit sector. So I felt that, I guess, that would be a good career change. Anyway, I never had to go there.
No, number two is going well.
Yes, exactly.
So going back to MT3, you became a part of McCarthy Tate Troll in the last couple years. And for listeners who may not be aware, McCarthy is a huge law firm based in Canada. So can you walk me through how that merger came to fruition?
Yeah, so Wortsmans had been successful in the Canadian market for about 8 or 9 years when I really started to think about different opportunities. I watched with interest all the acquisitions in the US and globally and analyzed the many reasons for expanding my firm's platform and client base. I was thinking a lot, why is there this huge consolidation in the industry of e-discovery providers? And I started to question whether my model was sustainable long-term or whether growth would solidify my team. So did it still make sense to be a small boutique firm advising on e-discovery? And part of it was I was seeing a lot of our law firm clients, the larger firms, building their own e-discovery internal tools, which also was shrinking the market. So after a bunch of soul searching, I decided the best move would be for me and my team to look for other opportunities to be acquired or to merge with another entity. I started to have conversations with other organizations. And then the opportunity with McCarthy came during a call, during a lunch actually that I was having with the new CEO of McCarthy's, who I knew through a running group. When he heard about my plans to make a move, his immediate response was, come join McCarthy's. So within days, I was in a meeting with the firm's director of innovation. We spent a Sunday mapping out a plan and deciding what it would look like to have my team and McCarthy's merge. So we'd have a national team of e-discovery professionals. And this was precipitously a really good time for the firm because it had been considering outsourcing their e-discovery needs. So everything moved really quickly. And it came as a bit of a surprise to them and a bit of a surprise to me. It moved so quickly. With an expedited due diligence process, we just agreed to pull the trigger and go ahead. And what was interesting about it is we were trying to make all these projections and see what it would look like for my team in the firm, and was there going to be work if some of my law firm clients moved elsewhere. And now looking back, it was like just, it was a great fit. We've been busy nonstop for three years. But when we used the, when we were negotiating it all, we used the dating analogy. So we'd known each other for a long time, for years, because McCarthy's had been a client of mine. So it wasn't love at first sight, but it turned out to be a lasting love.
Like a rom-com.
Exactly.
Best friend that was always there, and then one day you open your eyes.
Yeah, there, along those lines, that works.
That's great. So moving really quickly, obviously you did like a projection of how it will work from a financial perspective, as well as retaining clients. And when you hear about mergers, especially with larger companies, culture comes into play, right? How does the culture of the larger entity merge with what Wortsman's had and what makes it unique? So can you talk about how the cultures came into play and where you were at then and where you are now?
Well, so those bumps are really inevitable, but we worked jointly through them because everybody had the same goal. We wanted to succeed and we wanted to offer our clients the highest level of service. So, but it's been an interesting journey. Lots of different changes. So after year one, our name changed from Wortsman's to MT3. And we really tried to blend the McCarthy's team with our team. During the early days, I didn't really know a lot about change management, and the acquisition happened so quickly. But the firm was really supportive on the transition, giving us, you know, sort of help on finance and HR, project management and advisors. But in those early months, my team were reeling. So they joined a boutique law firm, and they're suddenly working at one of the country's largest firms, which was not what they signed up for. They didn't know if they were going to like it. And I think we got really lucky because we got busy so quickly. So within 3 months, we just ramped up. And my team didn't really have as much time to worry about change management and culture. It was worrying about getting the work done. And it turned out our culture and work ethic thrived in the McCarthy's environment. And, you know, we quickly tripled in size and new challenges arose. And then that also became part of the culture. Like, should we move into the McCarthy's office or stay in our own office? And we decided to stay in our own office, which turned out to be very good for our team because we're really close and we work really closely together. Other things that came up was being nimble. So when you're a small entrepreneurial firm, you're nimble, you can quickly make decisions about buying technology, and that doesn't always really work well in a larger environment, that agility that we really needed. So we struggled with that a little, and then quite quickly I got the support I needed from McCarthy's, and they really kept us as a separate division so that we could be autonomous and make decisions. And it was so successful at the firm that since then they've created 5 other divisions. So now we share resources, including like IT, HR, billings, and the six divisions in total all meet and talk about strategy and marketing initiatives. So the divisions remain nimble, but they're all still within the firm's mothership. So we've got MT Align now, which is like lawyers on demand, MT iPlus, which is immigration services, MT Play, which has gaming expertise, MT Ventures, which supports startups, and recently launched MT Version, which is a translation service. So MT3 sort of started the trend, and now there's more, and we share infrastructure with these divisions. And so the culture clash is really less because the divisions have some autonomy, and they all support each other.
That's helpful. So when looking at the other divisions and as you're collaborating, is there a common thread that makes it that you're a McCarthy entity? Like, what unites you all?
Innovation is what really ties us all together. We are all trying to offer legal services in a different, innovative way. And we're all working within the rubric of a law firm, but providing different solutions to clients.
Awesome. So shifting gears a little bit, when we chatted earlier during our allyship episode, you talked about what you have done in terms of empowering women and the dinners that are hosted by McCarthy that bring in women throughout the firm at the partner level or associate and wherever they might fall. Can you talk a little bit about those and the purpose and what you've heard from conversations?
Yeah, so these are annual dinners that are hosted every fall by in partners' homes, and they allow women to get together in a truly relaxed environment from partners, senior partners to junior associates. And it's really about opening up the conversations to whatever people want to talk about, whether it's about inclusivity and diversity in law or the partnership track for women. It can be all of those conversations that are sometimes really hard to raise as a young lawyer one-on-one. So the dinners offer a real forum for discussion. I have hosted them for the last 3 years since I joined the firm. And having the opportunity for young lawyers to talk about the issues and how their careers are progressing is important, both for them, but for the senior lawyers and partners as well, to offer advice and to hear the concerns. So I'm sure, you know, we all look at the statistics and we know how many women partners there are on average in law firms in Canada and the US, and it's certainly not 50-50. So we ask those questions, why is that and what can we do to change it and how can we move the needle?
So what are you finding those conversations bring to light? Like, what areas do you think can move the needle?
Well, in terms of gender equality, for example, we have to look at those mixes at different levels and different positions. So if we're talking about in tech and in the e-discovery world, it's actually interesting because in Canada, I see there's a lot of senior women on the legal side involved in e-discovery, probably less on the technology side. And it's always been interesting to me because years ago, I was taken aback when someone said to me that e-discovery was a natural thing for women because women are better at organizing things. And, you know, I thought hard about that and I thought, is that why I went into this? Because I'm good at organizing things? Like, really? And now I see that as just such a sexist way of assigning work and tasks to associates or saying, we're always going to push women into the big document cases because they can organize documents instead of having, like, you know, advisories, you know, important client work. And it's just clearly so wrong. So that statement offends me now, although I don't know that it did at the time as much. So if that myth still exists out there, that this is a place where we can put women who are really organized, that would really trouble me. But I don't think it's what I'm seeing, because I am seeing a lot more interchangeability in women amongst women and men in tech and legal in senior roles.
Yeah, I think I experience that in different ways than women do, just with these like things that people say that don't seem like a big deal. Like, okay, you can plan the Christmas party. It's like, well, I'm probably the last person that should plan anything. I am so disorganized. So that women are thought to take notes or do certain things during meetings that, you know, aren't intentionally harmful, but they perpetuate that stereotype that that's a women type task and they're inherently good at that.
Yeah. You know what, Mary, the party planning one is just a perfect example because, you know, we as women have to be really careful to take on those tasks and we need to share them with our male colleagues. If we're going to plan the party, get a guy to help you and, you know, let the guy in the room take the notes at the meeting. Or half the time the women. But, you know, at one point, actually, it was really interesting because we have we've got lawyers, we're sort of split up into teams of lawyers, project managers, and analysts. And our analyst team was all male at one point in time. And as we've integrated women into that team, the team's changed and they just added that diversity adds a wonderful perspective. And of course they're just as talented as the men on the team. So it's, you know, that's been a bit of an evolution too.
Definitely. I think it's just having those conversations that might seem awkward at the time, but just like, hey, Jim, you take notes this time.
That's right. But it's even strange because on the analyst side, and certainly in Canada, we just don't see as many, we didn't, I guess 10, 13 years ago, we didn't see as many men in that area. And now it's nice that we're starting to see more balance.
I know we only have a few minutes here, Susan, but you mentioned earlier that you're seeing more female leaders on the legal side and less so on the tech side. Why do you think there is that discrepancy?
I don't know. And it's just, it's very interesting because I look at a lot of the leaders at large firms in Canada and they are female. So I'm not sure how that has progressed or how those roles have developed, but there it is. And I'm not saying there aren't, you know, very, very strong, you know, men who are leading e-discovery teams in the Canada. Of course there are, but I don't know why that divide has sort of happened. And a lot of the men seem to be more focused in the forensic piece or running the analyst team. So I don't think I can explain it, but I do see it starting to change dramatically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've had conversations with other stellar women guests that can't pinpoint it, because I'm sure it's a very multifaceted reason, but it is the forensics or computer science is a more male-dominated field, and it's kind of changing the structure, unfortunately.
Yeah, although, and as I see it change and things start to modify, and I see senior male associates rise up in my team, and I see women on the analyst team, I see it making us a much stronger team. And you can see how that you know, diversity does help, you know, the diversity in many ways. It just helps expand and broaden our capabilities.
Definitely diversity on all facets just helps any team make better decisions, be more creative. Great. Well, Susan, thanks for catching up. It was great to talk with you, and thanks for joining the podcast.
Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate talking to you, Mary. Great. Take care.
Take care. And for Stellar Woman, I'm Mary Rectoris, signing off.